everyone, and welcome back to the Soldiers of Cinema podcast. With me, as always, is the fantastic, amazing, extraordinary Cullen McFader. What's going on, Mr. McFader?
Not too much, not too much. You could almost say that in, you know, a thick Irish accent for this episode.
if I could do it.
It is, when I was in Ireland, every single person that I introduced myself to would go, oh, good Irish name.
So. I don't know. Well, and my, at least my last name is Irish.
Yes,
Coffee.
Very Irish.
And I guess I should finish. And as always, I'm here as well.
Clark, oh, yes, Coffee. Yes, of course.
Clark Coffee and Cullen McFader. So now we're going to be discussing In the Name of the Father, hence our discussion of our Irish names. That's not why we picked this movie. And actually, this will be kind of interesting. This was my choice for the week, and I think this might be the first time. Matter of fact, I'm certain of it. This is the first time that I picked a film for the podcast totally blind. Mm-hmm. Every other film that, at least for me, I don't know, Cullen, about you, but every other film that I've picked for the podcast, I had seen before. So I kind of, you know, knew what I was getting into, so to speak, right? Either it was a film that, you know, I really enjoyed, or I thought there'd be a lot to talk about, or whatever the case may have been, but I had seen the film before at some point. And so this one I had not. This film was actually suggested to me by my wife. And I think she generally has a pretty good idea what kind of films I enjoy, what I'm into. Mm-hmm. And she caught this film herself not too long ago, and she asked me about it. She's like, hey, have you ever seen In the Name of the Father? I think you'd really like that. And I was like, you know, actually, believe it or not, even though I'm a big fan of Daniel Day-Lewis, I was like, you know, I actually haven't seen it. I don't think I have. So I totally went in blind. So... and if I'm not mistaken, it's the first time that you've seen the film as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think this is... And the same thing with the exception of our Herzog movies that we were doing kind of at the beginning of the podcast. I think this is the first time that, not the first time I've never seen one of your picks, but yeah, I think this is the first time either of us have chosen one that we haven't seen.
Right, right, right. And then you've picked some that I hadn't seen before, for sure. Mm-hmm. But this is the first time I have picked one that I myself hadn't seen.
It was a time of innocence.
No property, no law, just love.
What should we call you?
Call me Wales, come on.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine. Do the bump of dime in your prime.
Then you!
In the wake of the Guildford pub bombing deaths, the government has responded with emergency legislation and increased police powers of search and arrest.
Get him up!
I have a right to speak to my son.
You are in trouble, Conlon.
What are you charging me with?
The murders of five people.
Get out of your mind!
Who taught you how to make the bomb, Jerry?
I didn't do this. What are you trying to do to me?
Star, what are you doing in here?
Conspiracy to murder.
Their arrest was only the beginning.
My name's Giuseppe Conlon. I'm an innocent man. So's my son.
Of a remarkable journey.
All of the defendants claim that they were subjected to physical and mental abuse while under police custody.
Were never harmed in any way.
How do you find the defendants?
Guilty as charged.
From the hands of a government.
This is your home for the rest of your life.
Who knew they were innocent.
What are we going to do now?
Nothing.
To the heart of a lawyer.
This conspiracy of silence has kept my client behind bars for 14 years.
Determined to prove it.
They're as guilty as sin.
In the name of justice. In the name of truth. In the name of love. In the name of the Father.
So kind of interesting. But so for the both of us, you know, and as we usually do on this on the podcast, we kind of start off our discussion of each week's film with kind of our personal experience with the film, kind of when did we see it? What was the context? When kind of just on a gut level, what did we think of it? What was our emotional response? What did we like, not like? Just kind of at a real high level before we dive into some of the various aspects of the picture. But so we'll start with you, Cullen. What were your initial thoughts? I mean, obviously, I know you just recently saw it, so
this is the first time I'd seen it as well.
Yep.
And yeah, I liked it. I thought that it was. I mean, I like this. I find that the historical context in which it's set, the troubles and all that's a really interesting time period, and lots of really interesting and contemporary stories, I think, that come out of there, more so than perhaps other historical films about, you know, war or conflict or things like that tend to be.
No, you mean this back. Feels more contemporary to you?
Oh yeah, and you know the consequences sort of still reverberate today.
Okay.
And relate to a lot of the things that go on today. Especially because I was just in Ireland this past year. So there's a lot of very relevant stuff here that I found really interesting. Daniel Day-Lewis, obviously really, really great actor. He's, I think, you know, I don't think I'm saying anything controversial if I say he's arguably one of the greatest. And Pete Postlethwaite, who is someone I really like, who is
always
a joy to see. Like, he's someone that, you know, sadly passed away in I think 2011. So that's unfortunate, but I do love his work. But yeah, had never, I'd heard of this, but never seen it. Didn't really know what it was about, and so that was another thing that was interesting. Like the Guilford Four, who the film is about, I had heard of, but didn't know that this film was about that specific case.
Yeah.
But also found that the movie was interesting because it kind of takes this very personal spin on that. It doesn't spend a lot of time contextualizing and things like that. Like, it's very much from the point of view and perspective of Daniel Day-Lewis's character. So it, I thought that was kind of an interesting choice, that it doesn't, there's not, with exception to right before the end titles where it kind of gives those, you know, here's where they are today and this is
the context of what happened.
It doesn't spend a lot of time, you know, saying like, here's what the origin of this conflict is. Now, whether or not that was a choice made because it was supposed to be a personal story, or it was a choice made because it was a film that was clearly marketed heavily in Ireland as well, and that just, there was an expectation that people would understand that. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But either way, I think it works. I think that it does also, in contrast to me saying that it's a very contemporary and like relevant story, it also kind of makes it a bit timeless because it's less about a specific event and a specific issue and more about the relationships between these characters and kind of the harm that they go through. And it can be expanded to a wider critique of legal systems and of, you know, even just like cross-cultural differences and things like that. So I thought it was interesting. It dealt with a lot of interesting subject matter that, of course, we'll get into in more detail. But my first thoughts were enjoyed it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, I'm glad. You know, a lot of the thoughts that I had run pretty parallel to yours. It also struck me that the film didn't provide a lot of context for, you know, the larger goings on around the story, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think obviously in the UK, in Ireland, they probably wouldn't have to provide a whole lot of context, especially in 93. You're not as far removed from the Troubles as you are now, time-wise. In the United States, though, it's interesting. You know, this film did very well in the United States. It had a pretty decent box office, and it was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, which it won none of, and we can talk about that a little more later. But it was commercially and critically pretty successful here, and I think you would probably have to provide a little bit more context for the Troubles here. Although I think, you know, the average person has probably heard of it, kind of has like some inkling or idea, you know, Protestant, Catholic, UK, Ireland, you know. But I think a lot of the details of that aren't known to a U.S. audience. I mean, I don't want to presume or speak for anybody else, but I think on the whole, our understanding here in the United States would have been a little bit less. But I think you're right. In them not doing that, and kind of just, we jump right in, and we're in Belfast, and we're following this character, and there's really there isn't any explanation of, you know, why are they being shot at? Why are they being chased through the city? Really, not much, right? And we're just like immediately thrown into the lives of these characters in a very personal way, exactly as you state. And I think it is ultimately, you know, it's a very personal story. And I kind of like what they did there with the name, you know, In the Name of the Father, because a big chunk of this story is about Jerry Conlon and his father, mm-hmm. and their relationship. And to the extent to which when they are actually put in prison, they're put in prison together. And one of the poetic licenses this film takes is that the film actually puts them in the same cell.
Yes.
you know, so it's very much a story about that. But then, of course, the larger context, religion, of course, being a big part of this conflict that the story takes place in between, you know, the Protestants and Catholics. And so I think it seems very, you know, the intention from the get-go, I would presume, that they did this. But I thought it was really effective as well, because I think you're right. It allows it to transcend. It can speak very specifically to that conflict for those people who want it to. But it also can go beyond that to transcend just that conflict and speak to a lot more universal topics. And so I thought it was very effective in that way. Yeah, so I guess I would agree. I mean, I enjoyed the film. I was surprised I hadn't seen it before, because I'm a pretty big fan of Daniel Day-Lewis as well, and Emma and Pete. Emma Thompson is in this as well. I don't know if you mentioned that, but she has a role mm-hmm. here that yep. it's not huge, but she's extremely effective in it, as she always is. So I was kind of surprised I hadn't seen it myself, but I very much enjoyed it. And
I wonder if one of the reasons that they didn't provide context to was just because it was still going on at the time. Like, I wonder if there was just an expectation yeah. that people, because this was 93 and the Troubles officially ended in 98.
I think so.
So yeah. I do wonder if there was like, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, if you're making a movie about Vietnam during the Vietnam War, you're less likely to look at it from a historical lens and try to contextualize it, and more likely to set it in, you know, because it is contemporary. Yeah. So
that's fair. I think that's fair. It's totally possible. And again, you know, it could be that, you know, the people making this film were kind of, I think, by and large, right? I mean, Jim Sheridan mm-hmm. Was born in Dublin. I mean, I think you have people either from the UK or Ireland making this film. And so I think that's, you know, it's likely they didn't feel like they needed to provide any context. I yeah. think that's mm-hmm. right. I mean, at this point in time, I mean, that, you know, this is something that's been going on for a very long time. The Troubles specifically, I think, kind of started roughly around, you know, the 1960s or so. But obviously, aspects of this conflict and this relationship and issue hundreds of years before that. I'm no scholar in this area, but yeah, I think you're right. But of course, it's not afraid to take a stance, though, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, by the time we get, you know, it's kind of interesting. We have kind of the first. Not third, I don't mean this in running time, but you kind of had a first third where we get to know this character and Jerry and it's Jerry, right?
Yeah.
And Conlon and his father and kind of this, you know, and his, it's almost, I almost want to say coming of age, but it's not really. He's an older character already, but we're getting to know him personally. And then we kind of move into almost, you know, the second third, which is like this prison film in a way. And then we have almost like the third, you know, part of the film, which is this courtroom drama. But in the courtroom drama, I mean, I think, you know, the film makes a very strong, specific statement, right? Mm-hmm. That this was a miscarriage of justice. That, you know, the British government really, you know, unethically, erroneously imprisoned these people, took away a huge portion of their lives, and
in the end of course, one of theirs too.
Right, and of Pete's character. And so, so it's not afraid to make a statement, though, right, to have an opinion and a stance about this, at least mm-hmm. this specific part. Of that history, of that real history.
Well, I always find that there's kind of like a subgenre of movie with this very similar tone. Mm-hmm. That, like, I think of, like, just because I watched it actually relatively recently, like Empire of the Sun, the Spielberg movie,
okay,
with, yeah, Christian Bale, where it's like, yeah, there's this subgenre of, like, innocent person goes to prison and kind of there's this builds this camaraderie with people that they may at first have, you know, tension with or you know, animosity towards, and by the end kind of build a relationship. And but they all feel, I don't want to say they all feel the same in terms of like a, like that it's boring, but there's definitely these like kind of tropes in there where it's like, you've got like kind of the friendlier people.
Examples.
That, well, so you know, for example, the in Empire of the Sun, there's what's his name's character?
I haven't seen the film
Malkovich,
in a while.
John Malkovich.
I wish I could help you. Yeah.
John Malkovich, who kind of takes Christian Bale under his wing. In this one, there's like those, like, I think they're Jamaican guys that are sort of like down the hall, and they kind of like, I guess, help Jerry settle into the prison a little bit.
At least give him some drugs.
His first friends. Exactly. Let's give him some acid. You know, and I know you had earlier brought up Shawshank Redemption.
Well, we're talking, that, yeah, yeah.
There's
not
sort of
here,
like, it's that,
yeah,
similar idea of like, Morgan Freeman's character kind of helps Andy, I believe his name in the,
yep,
movie is,
kind
of settle in. And so there's this sort of like trajectory of these movies. But what's interesting about this is that it's not totally a prison movie. Like, it's probably a good,
not totally, yeah,
I mean, what is it? A good probably half hour, 45 minutes before they actually are imprisoned. And
I would say
the,
yeah,
first portion of it is, like you said, very kind of coming of age of this, like, you know, these people. The bizarre thing, I think, is just how Daniel Day-Lewis is older than you would expect, and obviously the character probably appropriate age, but,
yeah,
for the type of tone again that it's going forward, it's like you see this kind of like, he seems to be acting more like a teenage vagrant, like running through the streets of Belfast, like stealing old metal from, you know, abandoned houses, and then gets shot at, and he's not necessarily involved with the IRA, but the IRA kind of,
well, he's not political,
because,
I mean, they even,
yeah,
state that, right? His father is like, you know, he's not political, and,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
and
I,
so,
I mean, we,
so it's interesting, yeah, that the tone of the start of the film is very much like, yeah, like you kind of expect it to, without having known the true story of it, you almost expect it to go in this direction of like, oh yeah, this guy's just gonna, it's gonna be about this person's like up and coming life through the troubles, right, and that,
yeah,
in this city, and then, but then it kind of takes a few turns. Then he goes over to London,
yep,
to kind of, you know, get away from the stress of it and all that for a while, or sent away in a way.
Well, that's what's interesting, is that it's not even, I mean, just to kind of interject for a quick second here, I mean, and maybe in a sense it is a coming of age story, right? But it's one that kind of that tells the story of maybe a late bloomer in a certain sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I think Daniel Day-Lewis himself, as an actor, was in his mid-30s in 93, I think, or early 30s. And, you know, I'm not sure how old the, you know, the person the story is based on in real life was at this point in their life when this happened. I can't be sure. But I mean, we do get a sense, right? This character is kind of floating around, right? They're unemployed there. And maybe employment would have been very difficult at that point in time here, right? But he's unemployed. He's kind of aimless. He's still living with his parents. Now, again, that may have also been common, but he doesn't really seem to have any direction. He's got no family of his own. He, you know, as far as like a wife and children, he doesn't have his own home. He's still fighting with his father, almost like a teenager might, right? In some senses. Like you said, he's like picking scrap off a roof. He's, you know, kind of aimless, right? In a lot of ways.
Kind of in trouble with everybody too.
Kind of, yeah. Because it's like, hey, you know, I mean, on the, you know, you've got the IRA is kind of like, what are you doing, you thief? And you're bringing all this trouble upon us. You know, they basically have to create a riot in the beginning few minutes of the film to save his butt.
Yeah.
To
yeah.
As a distraction, as a decoy, because you've got soldiers running through the town trying to get him because they think he's a sniper. He's on top of the roof and he's playing like air guitar with like a broomstick or something, right? Isn't
yeah.
that while they're picking scrap metal off the roof? And so it's like, I mean, you kind of imagine this as like a 16, 17 year old kid would be doing something like that. But
yeah.
it's a full grown man. And you know, and I think it's kind of interesting that you have this character who certainly is no hero, and certainly, you know, isn't even necessarily likable, really, you know, in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Not many redeeming aspects, yeah.
Or at least that we can see, right? Yeah. I mean, he may not be horrible, but he's just like a dude. He's just a guy, you know, and he happens to be in this situation. And he's trying to do whatever the best he can. He's not exceptional in any way, particularly, except for his hair. I mean, he's got Daniel Day-Lewis has some amazing hair. Great hair.
he's got pretty much the same haircut that he has in Gangs of New York, which is a little funny.
Okay. I'd have to go back and look at that. You know, and then him and his buddy decide to kick off to London to kind of escape the insanity that they've got going on around them. And like you said, I think they're not anyone's favorite people in Belfast. And so they, you know, catch a ferry and hop on over to London. And what do they do there? I mean, they immediately they're meet up with some friends in this squatter house where they're tearing up the floorboards for firewood. And it's kind of like a hippie, new agey, kind of druggy kind of situation, a group of aimless young adults.
Vegetarians.
Yes. Vegetarians. That's what's important. And, you're right. And Jerry is like shunned for bringing like sausages into the house and his suitcase, right? That his mother packed for him. And, you know, aimless, right? And he's even the kind of character that, you know, they're walking down the street. They don't have a pot to piss in. They've kind of been kicked out of the squatter's house that they're in because they're kind of getting into it in politics with one of, you know, a couple of the other people there at the squatter house. And so they're like, hey, we're out of here. So they leave the only place they had to sleep that night. They're aimlessly wandering around. They run into this homeless guy, and this is going to end up being important later because this is this becomes their alibi. This becomes basically, you know, what sets them free 15 some odd years later when they finally are. This is a big part of it. But I mean, even to the point where, you know, this woman drops her wallet on the sidewalk while they're there, they grab it, literally break into her house and rob her, basically, right? I mean, rob this woman of 700-ish pounds, I think they say in the film.
Which is a lot of money. Still,
I mean, that's a lot of money now. But, it's 700 pounds then would have been, an extremely large sum of money. And what does he do? He buys, like a zoot suit, basically. And
dresses, like, a little bit like Ringo Starr.
kind of, you know, back in the late 60s or early 70s, you know. And comes back home and starts throwing money around, you know. So, you've got this interesting kind of setup where this person is clearly as far removed from, you know, being an activist or even kind of like a conscientious person. So I found that fascinating. I wasn't expecting that, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, I didn't know any of the story, but I just kind of had this thought that, oh, it's going to be kind of one of those biopics where... And we've talked about, you know, the whole biopic kind of thing before, right? We did Maestro a couple episodes back, and we kind of talked about that and biopics. But I was kind of pleased to see that they didn't try to turn this person into a symbol, that they left that humanity there.
And
left room for him to have that character to have an arc in the story. Because I think we've, you know, we've talked about this. We see, you know, a lot of biopics, they kind of, you know, take a complex, nuanced human being with like all different kinds of variances and shades and turn him or her into like a symbol, right? Mm-hmm. A myth almost, right? Something that's, they kind of strip away that humanity because, oh, you know, if we were to include some of these things, oh, that doesn't look very good. You know, this isn't going to show that person in a very good light. This isn't very flattering. This isn't, you know, and I appreciated the fact that this film didn't do that.
Yeah, no, it definitely kept the, I mean, even the introduction of the character who comes to the prison later, who is the actual IRA bomber of the Guildford pub.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's this very interesting, I mean, it definitely deals with the complexities of a a conflict like this, where, you know, I think that the film in general is anti-British occupation. I think history in a lot of ways has vindicated that, and it's definitely critical mm-hmm. of the British government and all that. But it also yeah. still, again, shows the issues with this kind of like ends justify the means conflict, and the way that the like, especially the specific IRA prisoner who comes in and very nearly, you know, sabotages a lot of what they are trying to do, despite the fact that he's, you know, maybe fighting for a good cause. But when he, for example, lights the guard on fire with this like mm-hmm. makeshift flamethrower,
yeah,
and it's kind of like, you know, you're screwing us over even more. Like, not only are we already in prison because of what you did, but now you're screwing over the process of us getting out and potentially, you know, sabotaging that.
Well, let's go back to that. I think there's some interesting, yeah, that is interesting. That's a good thought. And I think there's a few more pieces I want to add to that. You know, yeah. So it's fascinating. So we have this whole kind of the front end of the movie. And then now we kind of move into, again, it's like a shorthand, I'm kind of calling it like the prison, you know, part of the movie. And I think you're right, though. It doesn't fall fully into kind of like all of the prison movie tropes. But we do spend a lot of time there. And I think this is where the character, or the main character of the film, starts to kind of change. But he's still, you know, it's interesting. I mean, his whole family basically is thrown in jail, mm-hmm. and his friends.
Yeah, I think his father's sister, who's his aunt.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole slew of people. It's
yeah, because they were the Maguire Seven, so there were seven of them, and then the Guilford Four were the friends, yeah. the group yeah. of friends.
And
yeah,
it was him and his three friends, or the, you know, one close friend, and I don't know how close the others were, if they were just some people at the squatter house. But mm-hmm. I mean, you've got, you know, and again, it's I don't think it's his fault per se, right? I mean, it's not his fault that he was, erroneously. Tried and kind of made to a scapegoat. I mean, all of these people were, but what a horrible thing to have kind of on your shoulders, right? I mean, yeah. you think about, yeah. geez, you know, I kind of left home. I'm kind of goofing off. I, you know, kind of trying to escape things and went to London. I'm kind of just goofing off and doing drugs and living in this squatter house. And, you know, all of a sudden here I am, my whole freaking family is being tried and then ultimately, of course, convicted. Now we're all, my dad's in jail. He's old. He's not healthy. I'm in jail. My whole, you know, like a big percentage of my family, my friends. But they do show, you know, I think it's interesting. One of the things I found pretty effective, and I think it was effective for me primarily because of Daniel Day-Lewis's performance, was the kind of the interrogation, right? There's like these 7 days that they condense into mm-hmm. a few minutes in the film where he's being interrogated, because you kind of have to like understand as an audience, the film has to kind of sell, well, why would they sign the statements, right? So ultimately in the film, you know, the British have these statements, right? And of course, initially these characters are brought in and it's like, no, I didn't do this. I absolutely didn't do this. I have this alibi. Here I was doing yeah. this, I was doing that, but no, I didn't do this. I didn't do this. And then over the course of 7 days, the police basically wear them down and kind of play them against each other. And ultimately threaten him with like the, you know, we're going to kill your father. If you don't sign the statement saying you did this, we're going to kill your father.
Yeah.
And then he finally signs. But I think they did such an effective job of that. And for me, at least, I mean, not that the film didn't do a good job, but I really felt like this was one of the places where Daniel Day-Lewis's performance shines, because I feel like this is a place where the film could have really gone off the rails.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I feel like it could have gone over the top in a really like, you know, unintentionally funny way, but it doesn't. I think Daniel Day-Lewis is extraordinarily effective here. I mean, as he is throughout the film. There's a lot of places where he's like interestingly tender.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like, and it, where he's almost like crying in places that you wouldn't even expect. And I don't mean like full on like bawling, right? Like some kind of actor, but you'll just see like a tear fall from his eye. In these mm-hmm. Did you notice that at all?
Yeah,
in just
yeah.
these interesting places where he'd be having a conversation. There's a scene, he's having a conversation, and he'll be like crying. I found that like to be extremely fascinating.
Well, I also find it interesting because it makes that tenderness makes the moments when he does have these kind of outbursts a lot more impact. Like, so when his father first visits him in prison before I think his father has been convicted of anything or charged with anything.
His father comes out to try to help him or something, and then I think he goes back and he's going to try to get an attorney or help him fight it, and that's and when they rope him into it. Yep.
But that moment when they're in the cell and his father sort of asks if he did it, and Daniel Day-Lewis has this like great moment where he's kind of like he breaks down and sort of is you know, completely destroyed by the fact that his dad would even ask if he did it, as opposed to just, you know, believing that his son wouldn't, and talks about the, you know, when he was young playing, you know, when he was playing football. Well, and
it's like, why did you follow me? Like, why did you follow me here? You only follow me when you think I've done something wrong.
Yes.
You only follow me when you think I failed.
And so the emotions get very high, and he does, you know, he shouts in that, but that is one of, I think there's like maybe two or three scenes in the movie where that happens, and they're very impactful because of that, because of the fact that for the rest of the movie, he tends to be very, what's the word, understated and not calm, but in a way that isn't over the top, where he's like reserving it. It's like you can tell that he wants to reserve this, his sense of like personhood to become, you know, so that he doesn't lose his sense of self. But then there's obviously these moments that just break him. And of course, he's fantastic at doing that. I mean, you think he's an actor who has no fear of, he has no fear of looking ridiculous. And so that's why he doesn't look ridiculous when he does this, because there's so clearly a level of like a lack of self-consciousness about the way that he plays those moments that I think really, really ends up working. Whereas if you do have that level of self-consciousness, if you have someone who's worried about looking silly or looking over the top or something like that, you can usually tell that there's a level of restraint that they're doing in the way
There's a level of like self-criticism or self-awareness. Yes,
exactly.
Yeah, where they're kind of checking themselves. But I think he's really great
as you've seen in pretty much any of his roles, he's really great at just letting go in that way. And I mean, I know that he also went through, as he always does with his roles, where he kind of does them in this very method way. He spent, I think it was like maybe a week or something in prison. Went through interrogations, things like that, which of course, I mean, again, that they're even going through those things in a makeshift way would not nearly be as terrifying as going through them for real. You know, he just said he wanted to
get a sense,
feel the slightest taste of what would make someone confess like that.
Yeah.
And had the, you know, he said he instructed the crew to physically kind of abuse him and splash water on him and not let him sleep and, you know, all this stuff. So I think it does, you know, I think it shows he puts in the work. And I think that it, a lot of people are critical of like that whole method idea and things like that, but
well, it works.
It always gets him great results. There's some people it doesn't work for, but for I would say Daniel Day-Lewis had always. I've never watched a Daniel Day-Lewis performance and been like, yeah, that wasn't worth it.
No, it works for him. I think that's clear. You're right. It doesn't work for other people, or perhaps we won't go down that road of, you know, discussing method, quote unquote, method acting. And sometimes that term even gets kind of, you know, turned inside out and used incorrectly. But regardless of all of that, Daniel Day-Lewis, his performance here is exceptional. Of course, he was nominated, but didn't win an Academy Award. But like we discussed, the film was nominated for 7, actually. But lost primarily to Schindler's List, the big one.
Yeah, List was like the big one, movie.
But regardless, and you know, I think it's interesting. You talk about that moment when his father comes to the prison to talk to him for the first time since he's been there, and then of course ends up being imprisoned himself. And it is such a huge part of this film, and I think it's such a big part of what makes it successful is that it really does do a great job of focusing on this very personal story. And, you know, almost in a weird way, And again, if I were a greater scholar of the historical context, and I absolutely admit that so much of the nuance is lost on me because I am not, I almost wonder if there is an analogy, you know, between the son and the father character here and kind of this greater historical conflict between, you know, Ireland and Northern Ireland and England. But regardless of that, and smarter people with more historical context could maybe, you know, chime in and let us know, educate me at least. Cullen, you sound like you might even know more, you know more about it than I do. But regardless of that, it telling that personal story really does, you know, I think it's the heart of the film, makes it sing and has it really transcending. But yeah, I mean, I want to go back to, you mentioned something about, you know, being in the prison. And, you know, one of the things I found was interesting is that, you know, when we have, you know, Jerry in prison, now his father's there, we still don't see like really a significant change. You know, his arc is not, you know, the character is still, you know, it's kind of, he's fighting with his father, he's blaming his father, he's kind of, you know, he's like settling in almost like shockingly easy in a sense. You know, it's almost like, well, I didn't have a whole hell of a lot going in my life before this, and here I am in prison, and hey, I'll do some acid and hang out, you know, with the Rastafarian dudes, and, you know, I've got my Led Zeppelin and poster on my wall and my Hendrix poster on the wall, and, you know, I'm not going to help my dad, you know, campaign for justice for our release,
yeah, for
even,
the appeals and all that, yeah.
which is interesting. I mean, he's almost like this, you know, it's like I'm not even going to really try to help myself.
Yeah, he gets very
much less help my father.
Yeah,
and so, you know, I find that to be interesting because I think it's what you would expect, right? I think in most films you would expect, okay, well, now, you know, they're in prison and they've been wrongly imprisoned, and ooh, can you think of anything more horrible? And his whole family has been wrongfully imprisoned. All right, you know, this is the igniting point. This is the, you know, this is what they, you know, this is like the, you know, well past the inciting incident. This is like, you know, the moment of truth for our character, you know. But yet we really don't see any significant change, which I was kind of surprised about. I'm curious, did that strike you? Did you notice that too? Or,
well, I think it's interesting because the way that it progresses is, again, sort of oddly unexpected, where it's like he agrees to help his father while his father's still alive. And then he's sort of like, well, I can't write. I'm, you know, a bad writer, blah, blah,
blah. Well,
this
is even past that. This is, well, yeah. I mean, you're talking about, we're entering into the third act of the film here. Like, this is after they've been in prison for like 15 years.
Yes.
I mean, 15 years.
But I mean, even what's interesting about that is you expect, like, because then his father dies.
Yeah.
And in a more,
you,
I think, standard story, you would almost expect, like, the thing that's interesting with the writing is I'm pretty sure his dad actually, I believe, died only 5 years after they're imprisoned, like in real life.
Yeah,
and
maybe
so
they kind of changed the time
from
frames
from
a screen,
I think his dad, I'm pretty sure his dad died in 1980 or around 1980, and they were convicted in 76.
Well, I'm not sure how much time Jerry spent in prison before his father was imprisoned. So
the way the movie tells it makes it seem like there's a long time. Like, it makes it seem like the bulk of the prison sentence is prior to his.
Yeah, and I thought it was very specifically that that Jerry says at some point that he'd been in there for 15 years.
Yes,
could be mistaken, but I thought that was explicitly said.
I do recall that as well. But the reason that it's interesting though is I think that in like a more standard way to tell that story, it would be like he's jaded, he's nihilistic, he doesn't care, and then his father dies, and that's what kind of gives him, like, he's like, oh, you know what, that's wrong, and now I don't get to see my father be freed and all this stuff, and that's kind of what gives him the resolve to get out. But it doesn't really happen that way. Like, it's more like he, like you said, like he kind of maintains this nihilism throughout the, like, it's, I almost feel like the inciting incident is almost when the IRA guy burns the guard, and this kind of like this, because he's kind of becoming good friends with him, but then that happens and he's like, okay, you know what, I'm stepping away from this.
That's a really good point. I feel
it's interesting. Yeah,
Yeah, no, I feel like you're right. Yeah, it's, you know, we have this scene where, like you said, there's a character that comes into the prison in the middle of the film, and you know, he's the guy who bombed the pub, and he actually admits this to the police, the very people, the investigators who charged and imprisoned Jerry and his family. And of course they can't have this, right? That they can't have this loss of face. Mm-hmm. And we come to find out later that they manipulated evidence, withheld evidence, and
yeah, they withheld actually his witness,
exonerated. So, yeah. So we kind of find all that later in kind of that third courtroom drama act of the film. But he's in prison, and you're right, he is willing to resort to tactics that Jerry is absolutely not interested in. And we have this scene where he lights one of the guards on fire, and we actually even kind of see this guard. He's humanized to us. The film humanizes him. We have this like moment we see very specifically where the guard is talking to Jerry's father, mm-hmm. and having like a very kind of pleasant and almost sweet in a way conversation. Now there's a wall between them, but and of course one's a guard and one's a prisoner, so that's, you know, that's always going to exist, but he's kind of humanized. And then we get to this point. So we kind of have an idea that maybe he's not a horrible warden, or, you know, I think he's like a head guard or something, not the warden, but like a head guard, or he's the top man in that area of the prison.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when he's just viciously burned, by this other character who's admitted to the bombings. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I hadn't thought about that, but now that you mention it, I mean, I think, you know, that's when Jerry really, he has this moment where it's kind of like, boy, that was, you really did good now, didn't you, buddy? Yeah.
Yeah.
What a great day's work. You know, what a great day's work. Yeah. You know, that took, talk about, you know, courage. Yeah. You know, all the like steeped in this like sarcasm of like, wow, okay, so you think just lighting some guy on fire, that makes you a man? That's what we're trying to do here. And so you're right. I feel like that does kind of ignite some response from him, where we do see him kind of actually grappling with some kind of internal value structure, right? Like, mm-hmm. okay, where do I actually stand on these things? Because we don't really see any of that, or not much of that before, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you're right. Interestingly.
But it comes later than you would expect, too. Like, it almost like... It comes perhaps, I mean, not I wouldn't say too late. Like, it's not something that I think detracts from the movie, but just in terms of like the standard expectation you have, you would almost expect it to come much earlier in the film and have it be something that is like this almost after the inciting incident of going to prison.
Right. Then
this is
happens.
The resolve.
Yeah. Well, cause you'd have it right. It would be in your traditional pick. It would be like, okay, we're in the courtroom and he's convicted and his family's convicted and the judge is reading the sentences and it's like 30 to life. And then you would have like, you know, we'd have this push in on his face and it would be like, I am, you know, okay. We know from now to the end of the film, he is like, the resolve is there. He's going to fight, you know.
I'm going to become a legal scholar while I'm in prison. Yeah.
Because
even when Emma Thompson shows up, he
dismisses her.
He's
he
like,
totally
brushes
dismisses.
Her off.
No, he's like, he doesn't even want, he's like, no, forget it. I can do the time. He even says, he's like, I can do the time. I'm comfortable with this. I can do it. You know, I don't even know the language that you're speaking. He has this like, actually, it's a really nice moment. I think the scene is great. And he's kind of like, what are you even speaking this English? I wish that I could tear out my teeth and put my fist in my mouth because I don't even, you know, these mm-hmm. words, compassion, justice, just mean anything to me. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think we see like a hint of some poetry that might exist in him.
Yeah,
as a character, as a person, and so I think it's really what we see is interesting. Is like it's this. He doesn't actually, I think, blossom as a character until the very, very end when he exits through the front door of the courtroom. He's exonerated. His family's exonerated. He mm-hmm. exits, and he speaks to the press. And I think that's when he's changed. That
well,
that
even
last
and even
final
his,
moment.
When he's leaving the courtroom when he's exonerated, and he sort of says, like he says to the guard, I'm a free man. I'm going out the front door.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's this very, that's kind of a side of him that we haven't, that hasn't been seen. Like, sure, he's been stubborn. And
no, because he's totally the guy that would go out the back door. Like, yeah, he's,
but suddenly he's principle. Yeah. He's got this principle of like of justice, whatever that means, and that word means. But he has this idea that it's like, you know what? No, like I fought for this, and now I'm gonna.
And I think this film is a great example of taking the patience, right, of having the entire story. And obviously there's more to the story. You and I are kind of focusing on the main character's arc. There are other elements of it, but I do find this particular aspect of the film extremely interesting. But the film takes so much time to show the character unpleasant way. He's not super likable, but he's also not unlikable. He's just like a guy, you know, and he does some crappy things, and he struggles with some of the same things we all do. He's like frustrated with his father. He doesn't feel appreciated, all these things, right? He is wrongly accused, but he doesn't really know how to handle it. He doesn't have the faculty or the education or the wherewithal to even kind of grapple with that, much less these larger things going on in the world. And then we see these little moments, like you said, where the guard is caught on fire, where he's talking to Emin Tonson's lawyer character. And then, you know, by the time we get to the end of the film, he has a resolve that... Yeah. has been earned through all of these trials, literal and figurative. I think that aspect of the film impressed me the most. There's technical aspects of the film that I think that are compelling, and it's extremely well done. It's beautiful. I think it's well shot. It's not I think it's mostly matter-of-factly shot. There's some scenes in it that are really beautiful.
When they're like the newspapers up, and
when the prisoners are tossing burning newspapers down the exterior wall of the prison, I think it's when they find out Jerry's father has passed away.
That's really
beautiful, just extremely beautiful, beautiful visualization of that. But this particular aspect, this character arc, I think is what stood out to me the most, and that they had the confidence to carry that process and not have it really happen until the last moment of the film, literally the last scene, the last speech, you know, that he gives to the press, where it's like, hey, my father died in there, and we're going to work until we get, you know, till we clear his name. And
well, and it's interesting too, because it's, you also have, you know, again, Emma Thompson playing the lawyer who ultimately is the one that gets them out, or the one that is helping them on the outside.
In this like latter third, the courtroom drama part,
Like the movie opens with her. The movie opens with her listening to his kind of tape recording. So you expect her to have a much larger part. Again, in this sort of typical way that a movie like this would go, he would go to prison. Maybe you'd have 10, 20 minutes of him being kind of like the fish out of water in prison.
Yeah.
You know, fighting
off the other prisoners.
Yeah, like, in the shower or something.
We'd have to see how horrible it was.
Then you would introduce this lawyer character, then they would work together, and it would be about the trials and tribulations of them trying to prove their innocence. But it really isn't about that. It's really like she comes in again. She's introduced at the beginning, but then doesn't really show up until like the last third
later.
Of the film.
Yep.
And then at that point, she kind of has a few speed bumps, but ultimately, I mean, like, even when she goes into the thing and the guy's like, oh, he's off sick, you know, you can't, and she's like, just give me the thing. That actually ends up being, that speed bump ends up being what gives her the edge, because this new clerk of the files who is, you know, filling in for the other guy who's very restrictive with her, it accidentally gives her a file that exonerates
the juicy file. Yeah.
And so
I love that moment, I love that moment. I love how they handle that. I want you to keep going, but I just want to highlight, I thought that was a really well done scene, because there's also just like a little humor there in the film, I think, where, you know, they did a great job of kind of that feeling where you catch you think something's turned to doo-doo, but then it actually is like this huge boon, and you're like, yes, you know, like to yourself, like, yes, yeah. You know.
and then beyond that, like, there's not really any, again, there's not really many speed bumps that she faces. Like, there's not, like, they kind of just go to court at that point, and she's got this, like, smoking gun mm-hmm. that she whips out, and then they are exonerated. So it's not, it doesn't, like, I think that the movie is smart in the way that it doesn't focus on, kind of like we said at the beginning of the episode, it doesn't focus on all these kind of extraneous details of context and legal proceedings and, you know, okay, well, what's the historical precedent for all this stuff being said? And it really, right. focuses just on this character and kind of, I guess, begs you to ask the, like, begs the question of, even though this guy is, even when he gets out, like, he's not, he doesn't have this moment of change where he's like, you know what, now I'm a good person and I'm going to do good for, like, he still is the same person ultimately. Like, he still kind of has these little childish, even though his hair is slicked back at the end and it's not at the beginning. So clearly he's older.
And he's doing pull-ups.
Yes, he's doing pull-ups and he's been transferred to a Scottish prison. But he doesn't, it's not like he goes through this thing and becomes like a humanitarian. And like, yeah. And it's like, yeah. I'm going to fight. He, and I think that that's a very, again, like you said, a very brave thing to do, where it's like, we're not blowing the audience over the head with this idea of like, this is a really good person who's been wrongfully convicted.
They're a saint now. They're a martyr. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, we've got to get them out because of the good that they would do for the world. But rather it just kind of interrogates this idea of like, anybody could be swept up in something like this and be imprisoned. And when you're dealing with such powerful forces as essentially governments that don't want to be responsible to the people their that citizens. They are supposed to serve,
which are most governments.
Or even worse, I mean, when you think about this, like, this isn't even a situation of an outsider being convicted. Not that that makes it any better, but it's not like he's a Northern Irish citizen. Like, he is a civilian of the United Kingdom. This is his own government that mm-hmm, is doing mm-hmm. this to him. It's not like he is like an enemy of war or something, and he's being like, he's like a prisoner of war or something. This is his own government that's doing this to him. And so I think it even, you know, drives the point home even further that it's like, how else do you describe a second class citizen if not a group of people who are just basically automatically assumed to be guilty? And I think that it does, I'm sure I'm not saying anything particularly new here, but like, imagine the outrage had that happened to somebody from England, like in you know, that there was just this massive context of looking down on both the Northern Irish and the Irish, and many people would say that is one group ultimately. And I think that really does show it, that it's like, these are just regular people who have been swept up in this conflict for so long, and this is what happens ultimately when you've got these really awful ethnic tensions. And it begs the question again of like, what even is the use of all this? What's the point at the end of the day if this is how horrible it's making people's lives? So yeah, I think that it is very brave in the way that it does that. It doesn't like try and finger wag at being, you know, quote unquote, a bad citizen or a vagabond or something like that. Like, he very much is still that person by the end of the film. And yet the film successfully garners sympathy for that person, even though at the start of the movie, you're kind of thinking, or at least I was thinking, like, no, this guy's kind of a jerk. Like, he's like stealing stuff and he's living this or like,
at least,
you know,
I don't know, jerk, but yeah, I mean,
well, jerk in the sense, not like a mean person, but a jerk in the sense that he's like, you know, he's causing all these issues for a lot of other people mm-hmm. without any care that he is causing these issues. Yeah. And it does turn that around on you. You do sympathize with him at the end, and you are happy that he ultimately gets that justice. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I mean, any other things that you'd like to discuss or bring up here as we kind of wrap up this episode on In the Name of the Father?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the classic opening song by Bono and Sinead O'Connor, which is, I think, pretty good.
Yeah.
You got to have those two in a movie like this.
I mean, of course, right? In 93, you have to have. Yeah. Yes. Oh my. I am not even sure if I was familiar with that song, to be honest. When I heard it, of course I immediately recognized the voices. Mm-hmm. But I was like, I don't really recall hearing this song. Mm-hmm. You know, back then in 93, and I guess maybe I would have been listening to different music. Although I feel like at least you too. I was obviously familiar with Sinead O'Connor, but anyway, all right then. Well, hey, that wraps up another episode of mm-hmm. Soldiers of Cinema podcast in the name of the Father. And as always, I enjoyed our conversation. I can't wait to know your pick for the next episode. I'll be waiting with like bated breath. So, all right, everybody. Well, thanks for listening. We appreciate you. We hope you enjoyed it. If you haven't seen this flick, go check it out. It's really worth your time. Until next time, we'll see you on the flip side. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.